I think, I'm not quite sure, but I think our group did make application to the Congress, but on account of representing two different classes of labor, it wasn't allowed to be recognized as eligible to join the Congress. That's as I understand something.
When was this?
Oh, that's about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago.
5 or 6 years? Oh, I see. But yeah. Before that, there were no attempts?
Oh, no. Before this Congress, the two joined, there was no attempt at any time to affiliate. And we are not affiliated either in the United States or Canada.
And the question never came up?
Well, the question has never come up because we have been an independent group, that is, the railway group, you see.
And were you ever invited to join?
No, I don't think so. Not that I know of. I'm not aware of that anyway.
Did you ever get into... Was there ever any attempt by other unions to organize the OBU? Did they ever try to take over in your field?
Well, the OBU did endeavor to raid the railway organization in 1919 in Winnipeg. And to a certain extent, they did. And a great number of men that belonged to the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen did join with them, and there was considerable trouble, and some of them were dismissed from service, and it then had to make application to the firemen to ask them to ask for their reinstatement on the railway, and I think practically all of them were brought back into service.
So they didn't really come out?
No, it faded out, of course. There was a lot of trouble in 1919 around Winnipeg, subsequent to the First Great War.
Well, what about in B.C.? Were they...
No, we have never had any raiding in B.C., to my knowledge.
So you never had trouble with the OBU in B.C. either?
No, whatever.
And you had railway locals in Vancouver, did you?
Railway locals?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
For instance, I noticed the CBRT doesn't have a railway local in Vancouver.
Well, they have never raided the international organization. And to my knowledge, they have never attempted to do it in British Columbia.
Your unions, now for a while the railway unions were one of the biggest groups of organized labor, isn't that right?
That's right.
But they aren't really that anymore. There are other large unions now.
Oh yes.
Larger ones.
Of course, the railway groups were the earliest organized groups in America outside of the typographical union. The typographical union, I think, were about the same as ours. Our organization, the Brotherhood of Railroad Engineers, is over 100 years old, you know.
In Vancouver?
No. In Vancouver, ours started in 1886.
1886.
Yes. That's the charter that was given to us. It was in 1886.
And that you still hold the same charter?
Still hold the same charter.
Which makes you one of the oldest unions in the province.
Well, that is correct, you see.
That's right. Yeah. What is the local number?
320.
320.
Division 320, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers.
You try to organize other railways, for instance, on the island?
Oh, we have on the island, yes.
Did you?
In the early days, I was chairman of the railway on the ENN, and
we gave
the ENN a charter. They have a charter, it's number 510, or 501, I think.
What about now Dunsmuir, for instance?
I beg your pardon?
Dunsmuir, James Dunsmuir, built
well,
a railway.
In the early days, James Dunsmuir didn't agree with us, and we could never
That's
make
right.
a contract with him. But his engineers did come to our division and were initiated in that. Now, when the railway was taken over by the CPR, that would be in 1910, when the E&M was absorbed, we absorbed them right into the British Columbia District. Then the CPR found out they were up against trouble in regard to the Songhee Indian Reserve over there. So Mr. Marple came to me and asked me to again separate our schedules and seniority list from the E&M. And when they got that settled, he would again amalgamate the schedule. Later, in about 1913, Mr. Marple came to me and was willing to do it. But at that time, the men on the island had already got their schedule, and they didn't see fit to again become part of the British Columbia District. So since that, they have been the E&N Railway subject to themselves. It, at that time,
their own local.
As their own local.
But you never organized under Dunsmuir, eh?
We could not organize under Dunsmuir.
Do you remember anything about that?
We could never do anything with Mr. Dunsmuir, but you must remember. But that's when we had, that's when Mr. Hawthorne Waite and Price, Parker Williams, you know, Parker Williams went to jail, you know, so, over there. That was the miners' strike. That was in 1912,
14?
No, previous to that.
Previous to that.
Miners' strike must have been, well, like 1934, 1935, something like that.
It was a big strike then. And
well, there was a big strike there.
You refused to cross the lines, or?
Say, there was no such thing as picket lines in those days, brother. That's something later. In my early days, as far as the railways were concerned, they didn't realize anything about picket lines. You must remember the first person that brought picket lines, and the one person in this world that made it was Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt. She refused to go across a picket line. That they were picking it from some hotel, and she refused to go into the hotel. Now that's the first time that I realized that picket lines were observed. Previous to that, picket lines were not observed, and she was one of the great women of the world that did that. Now in our early days, we had a contract, and as far as we were concerned, railway men, it didn't matter what it was, our contract was our contract, and we carried that out. Since that, of course, we'd like to save other people. We don't cross picket lines. But you must remember the picket line business has only come into effect just as I tell it. And I think
Eleanor Roosevelt
will tell you the same as I say. But Mrs. Roosevelt, you've got to thank her. She was the lady that first refused to go across a picket line.
When was this? Do you remember the date?
Well,
it
was during Mr. Roosevelt's time. We've got to go back. That would be, I can't remember the date, but you can look that up. You'll have to make a little research on these things, you know, because what I'm only giving you from memory, you see. But you can find out when Mrs. Roosevelt, that'll be down here in the library, you'll be able to find that out, when she refused, and she did make an issue of it, you know.
But do you remember what strike it was?
It was hotel people, evidently. I think so, anyway. Whatever it was, she refused to go across the picket line, and then organized labor took that up. They refused to go against other people's picket line. But she really is the woman that established it, as far as I can remember. I do take my hat off to her for that.
Do you remember anything about trying to, there must have been attempts to organize on the island and the Densmore?
There was never any attempt to organize. There was nobody to organize.
I see.
The crews there were so fearful of losing their jobs that you couldn't get to organize them.
Remember,
in the early days, it wasn't like it is today, you know, to go out and organize people. People had to get that thought themselves that they wanted to join an organization. When I joined an organization, just as you read, if you read there, not that I give you, men came and asked to join the firemen's organization and were willing to pay $2 application and $10 initiation fee. My gosh, that was a lot of money in those days, boys, because I'm going to tell you, those fellows were only earning $1.50 and $1.68 a day. And who would right now be willing to go to work and sacrifice 10 days pay to join an organization? Not for any money. That would mean if a partner were joining today, he'd have to pay about $300. There is the documentary stuff in that little book there where these boys, and they came along and wanted to join. They were never asked. There was no organizer.
And they didn't have to, but they just wanted to.
They just wanted. They just knew that that was it. We had men. The first railway that was organized, that is the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, was organized on the Intercolonial Railway. And they notified these men that when they organized, that as long that gave them 30 days or 20 days to quit the organization or leave the railway. A great number of the men did leave the railway. Mr. Creelman, Mr. McCarricker, and Ed Austin, and several other men. They came out here on windjammers around the Horn. Came out here because this rail was under construction. Mr. Underdonk, he was a Jew, but he said, "I'll take you all." And he says, "You can organize out here if you wish to." He said, I want engineers." And they all went to work on this construction right out of Yale. That was in the early days of the construction of Canadian Pacific Railway. But those men gave up their job rather than quit their organization. I'm going back now to about 1880, 81. But those were the men, Charlie Brown, another one, they were the men that made up or built up this labor group in British Columbia. They were the fellows that came here, were willing to give up rather than have the railway tell them that they had to quit. Or
they weren't Americans, were they?
No, they were Canadians down on the Intercolonial Railway down in.
No, but I mean, they came from the States, or
no, they came up, and in those days, to get to British Columbia, you had to come around the Cape Horn. And they were making steel for steel rails down there in Cape Breton. And those ships, those fellows came out here as sailors, out here to get a job on this construction out here on this end. And of course we had many men, Ash Kennedy and those people, they came up to Winnipeg. And those were the men, the nucleus of the men that brought organization into this country.
And they actually started organizing the railways around 1880.
1886 was the first charter, that's our charter, that was given in British Columbia for labor organization.
And when When did you join the union again? When was it?
I joined the firemen in the year 1900. And then I stayed with the firemen. You see, I was promoted to be an engineer in 1903. And under the laws of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers in those days, a man had to serve 1 year before he could, as an engineer, before he could apply to belong to the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. You had to still belong to the firemen until you could join the engineers. So I made application then to join the engineers in 1904, and I became joined the engineers in January 1905.
But did you met some of the fellows that got the union started here?
Oh, I worked with them.
Yeah. What do you remember?
Of course, when I started, the railway was only 15 years old, you see.
Where were you working?
Out of here in Vancouver.
And do you remember of these pioneers, more or less, the union?
I can only say that they were the strongest organized men that I've ever run up against. It was all Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, or Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, or Brotherhood of Railway Trainmen, Order of Railway Conductors. They were all true to their organization. And they, whenever there was a meeting, and they were in the city, they were at the meeting, and they were voicing their opinion. And they told their chairman what they wanted. Now today, I find in all labor organizations, the membership do not attend. And that's their trouble today. We don't get the men out to meetings that we should have. And though you can only get it, the chairman is only one man. He can only think one way. But if you have 100 men and you have 100 different ideas, you can consolidate them and then maybe work something out. But that's our trouble today. Men are just due payers as a rule. They're not members of organizations. They haven't got the organization at their heart.
So it was a much livelier, more dedicated group.
They were dedicated to it. And that is why our labor group has got to where it is. I can go back to your membership, the men that were dedicated. Percy Bengough, Chris Pritchard, Jameson, musician men.
Yeah.
Those men are all dedicated men.
Yeah.
Those fellows were dedicated to it. And that's why we've come up. And Bill Page, some of those fellows were dedicated to what they were doing. But today, no. Nobody cares. That the executive to it. And then they complain about what the executive does.
Yeah.
They don't attend the meetings. They have a voice the same as anybody else if they'll only exert it.
What about who were who were the leaders of the first local
here in British Columbia? The first leader was Robert Mee.
How do you spell his name?
Bob Mee.
M-E-E? M-E-E.
Yeah. And then I followed him.
I see. And what do you remember of this fellow? What was he like?
Well, he was a very fine gentleman. In those days, he was one of the highest thought of men in British Columbia, as far as that's concerned. Of course, I'm talking when British Columbia was small, and he had a lot of property here in Vancouver, became quite a wealthy man. And that is as it went in those days, you understand. Of course, nothing to what it would be today. But I'm talking of pioneer days, you see. Mr. Mee was very well thought of. We had another gentleman that was for a while with Mr. E.J. Hosker, Teddy Hosker.
How do you spell that?
H-O-S-K-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
He was Mr. Mee, and then Mr. Mee dropped out for a while.
Was he president of the union?
I beg your pardon?
Was he the president? Or
Well, the president isn't the highest officer in the president of the organization. The chairman is the man that is really
the big leader.
Yeah.
And he was the chairman.
He was the chairman.
The first chairman.
Of course, you have in presiding at the meeting, we call him the chief engineer.
Yeah.
But he is the head of the organization. But the head of the other officers, such as the legislative representative and the local chairman, we call local chairman, that is your man that negotiates your contracts and that. They are the head of the organization, really. The organization wouldn't exist without them.
Where was he, a Canadian-born man? Me?
Yeah, Robert Mee was. I think he was Irish.
Irish?
Yes.
How old was he?
I beg your pardon?
How old was he?
Well, he died when he was 57.
Well, was he was older than you. How many years older?
Oh, gosh, I was a boy of 19 when he was 55.
I see.
Of course, all those men were older than me because I started on the railroad when I was 18,
yeah.
You see.
Mm-hmm. This way you can...
I beg your pardon?
But this way, if you compare it to you, we can figure out pretty well when he was born.
In those days, I used to think he was an old man.
Yeah.
Because all those fellows used to have long whiskers, you know, in those days.
And he was the fellow that organized it.
He was a very strong organizer. That is, you might as well say he was a dictator, because what words he said was law.
I see. What about the international? Did they send anybody up?
We never had any dealings much with the international. The international, you see, as far as our brotherhood is concerned, there's none of our money goes out of Canada. I might tell you that.
Mm.
All our money, we don't pay any dues. We pay dues, but it's banked in Canada. And when I might tell you too. When times were hard in the United States, our organization was glad to have the money, you see. We carry over $1 million in the Canadian Bank of Commerce in Toronto at all times. And in addition to that, we have bonds in all provinces. We have money invested in every province in Canada. So as far as our organization, and it's a very wealthy organization, our organization. We have two immense buildings in Cleveland, you know, the bank building and the Pia Valley building. So here's an organization that doesn't take 1 cent out of Canada. In fact, as I told you before, they were glad to have their money in because when the banks tied up in the United States and we still had our money in Canada to operate that they could draw on from and pay back when it's necessary. Of course, we do support, we have to pay our dues just to the Grand Office the same as anybody else, but it's all done through our bank in Canada. At all times, any officer that is paid by the Grand Office is paid in Canadian funds, not in American funds, because it's all drawn from our source in Canada, you understand.
Did the other railway unions organize at the same time as you did?
No, the engineers were the first, and then the conductors followed, I think, in about 1 year afterwards. I think they...
When was the engineers?
Oh, in our organization organized?
Yeah.
Oh, well, our organization was the first organization, as far as that's concerned, in the United States. When it was organized, in Detroit.
No, what I mean is in BC.
Well, in BC, yes.
Were they all set up at once, or how?
Our organization was the first one that organized, and then the conductors started in 1887.
Yeah.
And I think that the trainmen and firemen followed as soon afterwards as possible. But of course, as I tell you, our men came out from the east that had left the intercolonial, and they were the men that started this organization here. And they did not have that same nucleus of men to draw from to start conductors, trainmen, and others. They had to get in line and follow what the engineers had first done.
Do you remember anything about them getting organized, or do you know
that's before my time.
That was before
1886.
Your time, right? Do you know whether they had much opposition from the CPR?
Oh, then, no.
Let's get back to the carpenters now.
Well, I'm talking about all trades that organize about this date.
This was
I do not think.
The 1898,
yes. I don't think that the attitude was fair, and I don't think it's fair at this time either. If contractors have a certain amount of work and they have contracted to on that basis, that there were, of course, in the early days there was no escalator clause to say if raises wage then we'd have to have an increase in the price, but the contract was set for that price. And in that way, the contractor was up against it and really forced him out of business altogether. I don't think it was fair if the contractor had been advised that when all such work that he had fully completed, then the increase would be such and such. I think it would have been more maybe amicably settled at that time. It did work so that a great number of people, and I must say there was a lumber firm at that time, and they were only in a small way in starting in business, that was Robertson Hackett, and they became quite financially embarrassed. While the banks did carry them on, these other contractors had to go out of business.
So they went out of business, and you said that new people came in, or what?
New people came in because there was a new era of other contractors, because these people had gone out of business. They couldn't do anything else.
And the new people were Americans mostly? Or?
Well, it was mostly Americans that came up from the other side at that time and started in business here. You must remember, we were just starting in an expansion then. There was quite a little boom going on in regard to expansion in this city. The city at that time only had a population, I would say, of about maybe 40 or 50,000 people. And that would be the outside. And we did start to expand because all that property in the West End was being opened up to settlement at that time. And there was a lot of business that went on. So I think that...
Now your father was an employer.
I beg pardon?
Your father was an employer.
Yeah, my father was a contractor and an employer.
And he went out of business.
He went out of business,
well,
and returned to England.
Well, but sir, what did he try? Did he not try to do anything about it? Or did they have a strike?
An Englishman in those days, if he went bankrupt, it was supposed to be hurt his character.
No, yeah.
That's right. His character couldn't stand that, and
no.
There was no endeavor, because what could you do? You just had to fold up.
What I mean was, was there no negotiation between the carpenters and the employers?
Well, the carpenters organized, and then they set a rate, and it would have been a strike. That's all there was to it. They refused to work. when they joined an organization. There was no organization previous to this.
And that was, the employers had to give in.
Well, the employers, there was nothing else for them to do. If you couldn't get men, what could you do?
They were pretty well organized then.
Well, they did. They organized very, very well.
They did.
They did a wonderful job of it, because they jumped from 25 cents to 50 cents an hour.
Just like that.
And for many years after that, they didn't make any more advances.
Well, do you remember how it happened? I mean, did they just
Well, of course, I was young at that time. And you must remember, I was only a young fellow and didn't realize what really took place. I'm only saying that it did. My father was in a very nice way here, and he just felt that he couldn't just take it, and he just left the country. That's all there was to it.
So there was really no negotiation going on?
I beg your pardon?
Was there any negotiation?
There was no negotiation.
It's just the carpenters decided.
It just came as a flash to the contractors at that time.
Well, what happened to them when the new contractors came in?
Well, the new contractors worked with the, they knew that they had to pay that rate. And that's all there was to it. And a lot of these buildings had to be finished by other people, because those people could not carry on. It was really a poorly handled thing at that time, I think. Of course, being young, I can't remember all the incidents of it. I don't know, there may have been negotiations, I couldn't tell you, because I wasn't part of my father's business by any means in those days, you know.
Well, do you remember any other, this is in 1896, isn't it?
Between 1896 and 98.
Do you remember anything else then going on at that time?
Well, that's the first that I remember of any organization, as far as I know that in later years, when I became organized as a railway man and that, saw what organization did, I know that I wanted to get unionized suits, and I couldn't get a union suit in the city of Vancouver. I went after the Trades and Labor Council. The only people I could get with a union label in was the tip-top tailors. And I might say that I have dealt with them ever since, and every one of my suits you can see a label for the tip-top tailor.
I got it.
Hey?
I got a union label here too. And
is that what's yours?
No, it's Hudson's Bay. It's a Hudson's Bay union suit.
Well, I like it. But I must say that one time I spoke to one of your gentlemen that was, I happened to be working with him on a board. And I asked him if he had any union labels, and he didn't have a union label on anything he had. My shoes were union label, and my hat was union label, and my... Well, that's what I say. We have that now. But I did, in 1919, I went after, of course I was in the chairman then, and I did go after the Trades and Labor Council. They didn't have a union table. Mr. Cleland was the gentleman that I dealt with then, and they didn't have anybody that they could recommend a union tailor.
Well, that's funny, because I was reading through the Labor Council minutes, and this was 1902.
Yes.
And they had a rule then at the Trades and Labor Council that every 3 months, all the delegates were inspected, and they had to have at least one union label. And if they didn't have it, the union was asked to withdraw the delegate.
In here?
In Vancouver.
In 1902?
That's right.
They had what?
No, they had a union label committee. And the committee would, every 3 months, inspect all the delegates to the Trades and Labor Council.
and see if they checked whether they had a union label on their clothes. And if they didn't have it, they could, their union would get born. And the second time, if they didn't have it for a second time, then the union would be asked to send a new delegate.
I think that's baloney.
You think so?
Yes, so that's baloney, because I'm going to tell you that in 1944,
yeah.
I was sitting on a board with the president of the Trades and Labor Council, and that's what I said to him, and he didn't have a Trades and Labor Council on, or didn't have a union label on anything. That's right. Now, I think what they've been telling you is baloney, because I'm telling you that in 1900 and between 1914 and 1999, I was between the First World War, and I can tell you the boys that were two Claridge boys, you know them, one of these boys plays in the
Lions.
In the Lions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Frank Claridge, he came to me and he wanted, he was a wiper, but times were hard and he had to go out to another job, and he was selling suits. So I said, all right, Frank, I'll buy a suit from you. I have union label. So the outfit he was working for were up in that Rogers building. And so they said, oh yes, we put the union label on. Well, that is to sell me the suit, you see. So I bought the suit, and I paid for the suit, no union label. So I went after this outfit, and then they give me the runaround on it. So then I went after the Trades and Labor Council. And they did not have a place in this city with a union label at that time on clothing. Now, Frank Claridge can back me up in that, because he's the boy that sold me the suit, and it wasn't his fault, because he went out and sold suits to all the railway men, you understand, and they did not have it. Now I went after, I know that the gentleman I got a hold of was a name, Mr. Cleland. If you look back in the records, I can't remember whether he was the president at that time or not, but he told me no, that they didn't have it, that was it. But I had already fought from the, been dealing with the tip-top, and I deal with the tip-top. The last suit I got was just last year, and I've still been dealing with them, because they have always given me the satisfaction. But nevertheless, that suit is made in Toronto. I'd sooner have it made in Vancouver if I could.